This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Dia Abdo grew up a Palestinian living in Jordan, studying American and British literature. She was pursuing her master's degree at Drew University in New Jersey when September 11, 2001 happened. And after that, a lot of people expected her to be the voice of Arab and Muslim women. Being just one person, she considered that a pretty tall order. Nevertheless, she started to study Arab women writers and Islamic feminism, which she now teaches along with her English curriculum as an associate professor at Guilford College. Dia Abdo, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to be here.
Will you tell us a little bit about the Palestinian presence in Jordan first and how your family came to be there?
Right. So my family, both of my parents, are from the suburbs of Jerusalem, one of the mounts of Jerusalem, Jabal al-Mukabbir. And we're from a pretty big tribe, even though my family settled and lived as peasants, you know, in Jabal al-Mukabbir. And then in 1967, after the Arab-Israeli conflict, some of my family members found themselves forced to relocate to Jordan. And my immediate family was of that group. And so my grandmother, with her two children, she was separated from my grandfather at the time, crossed the River Jordan, and really became a refugee in Jordan. And struggled to make ends meet. She used to knit loofahs to make a living and put her two children through school. And then my mother married my father, who's also sort of a distant cousin of hers. And we've been in Jordan ever since. I was born in Jordan, and I've lived there all of my life until I came to the U.S. To pursue graduate school.
What is it like for Palestinians in Jordan?
I think it really it would depend on the class of Palestinians that we're talking about. So my family, we lived a sort of fairly lower middle class life. So it wasn't a terrible struggle, but I would say that for the Palestinians living in the refugee camps, who still live in refugee camps, like Al-Ba'a, for example, their life is incredibly difficult because they still live in dire circumstances. So beyond the material, in other words, beyond the fact of, you know, just day-to-day living, some Palestinians find it very hard to survive. I would say that politically, emotionally, psychologically, you always feel like the other, even though Palestinians make up a significant portion of the Jordanian population. It did feel like we were outsiders.
It's interesting that you say that, and this is all the more instructive for an American audience who may tend to think that there is a kind of unified, monolithic Muslim identity
right.
or an Arab identity. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's been a refugee in your circumstances or your families can tell a different story.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, this is part of what I like to talk about and teach in my classes, the ways in which the Arab world is anything but homogeneous. And in fact, that, you know, the Arab world is not all Muslims. You know, there are Arab Jews, there are Arab Christians. But yes, especially in Jordan now after the Gulf War and now with what's happening in Syria, the Jordanian population is becoming a real mosaic of multiple identities, nationalities, refugee groups that are changing the landscape of Jordan.
You can think and speak articulately about those identities now. Growing up, was that any part of your consciousness? Is that how you thought of yourself?
Oh, absolutely. It was very clear. I mean, the way that my family talked to me, the way that my grandmother, my grandmother's a very important presence in my life, was she passed away, but she was a very proud Palestinian. And to her, having to leave Palestine was one of the most traumatic experiences. It was her dream that she would go back, and unfortunately she passed away before she could. She couldn't even get a visa to go back and visit her family. And so being Palestinian was the primary identity marker for me, that Palestine was home, that Jordan is our second home. It was something that was part of our consciousness growing up. And of course, any identity is almost always defined by its difference from other identities. And so being Palestinian in Jordan meant that we were not Jordanians. Right? That to be Palestinian meant that we were not Jordanians.
But you became very interested in American literature.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I think if you grow up in a country like Jordan, which was very much part of the colonial imperial effort, then you grow up interested in that which was or is touted as the most interesting, the most important. And so I went to a school where we were taught British literature, European history, American literature, and that to me was always the model. It was the model of what literature was. That was good literature.
And I mean, did you find it compelling? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, I can do well on the test because mm-hmm. I know what they're asking for, but it's quite another to have this reach you and touch you in a deep
yes.
way.
Yes. I mean, I think I love literature. I love characters. It's the psychological aspects of characters that draws me. But why American literature and why British literature? I do maintain that it's because of the ways in which it was presented to us as representing the it was what identity was, right? That this was how human beings lived in a complex way. Right. And so it was the complexity of that that drew me.
So tell us about your transition then to the United States when you attended Drew University in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for my undergraduate work, I went to a university in Jordan, Yarmouk University, which is on the northern border, very close to Syria, in fact, only 45 minutes away. And there I studied American literature. And I knew all along that I was going to pursue graduate work, was going to get a degree in American literature and come back and teach in Jordan. And so when I left for the U.S., that's what I studied. I was especially interested in poetry. And when I got to the U.S., and that's how it started, I was interested in American literature. I took American Lit courses, and then September 11th happened, and the world changed for many Arabs and Muslims.
We'll find out how that changed as we continue our conversation with Guilford College Associate Professor Dia Abdo on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today talking with Guilford College Associate Professor Dia Abdo. She teaches courses in English literature as well as Arab women writers and Islamic feminism. And you say some of this started when you were in New Jersey and suddenly became the Arab and the Muslim spokesman for the entire universe. So tell us how your life is changing.
The universe of Drew University, at least.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. I mean, there were many Arab students at Drew University at the time. And of course, after September 11th, everybody became really interested in Arab and Muslim peoples, and especially Arab and Muslim women, because the war on terror, like all wars, became or included a gendered aspect, right? So the world became very interested in the way that Arab and Muslim women were oppressed, because that became very quickly part of the rhetoric. And so it's, you know, what's better than talking to an honest-to-goodness true Arab and Muslim women who can authenticate these experiences? And so it was a lot of pressure to be asked to represent and to speak for and about Arab and Muslim women, especially when, as you mentioned earlier, the Arab and Muslim world is so incredibly vast, heterogeneous. And so it became very apparent to me very quickly that I could not be a representative, because not only am I just one person, I did not know enough. I mean, I grew up in the Arab world, but I grew up as part of the colonial legacy. And so most of what I'd learned, most of what I know, what I knew was about the non-Arab world, especially the European world.
Or the European view of the Arab
world. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The European experience.
Yeah.
And so I started to read. And this is when I discovered the world of Arab women writers. And my interests in literature shifted very quickly from American literature, even though I sustained that. But my research then turned to Arab women writers. And then beyond that, Arab and Islamic feminisms. Because even within the world of Arab and Islamic feminisms, I mean, it's an entire world. There are many kinds of Arab and Islamic feminisms across the spectrum, from the secular to the Islamicist.
How aware of you were you of this other world and the vastness of it before people started asking you questions?
I would say very little. I mean, I hadn't read any Arab woman writers. It's shocking. I'm an Arab woman, and I hadn't read any Arab woman writers by that point. It's really embarrassing. When I discovered that world, it was a pivotal moment for me. I'm sure you've heard this said over and over again, but the media, the things that we read really inform how we see ourselves. And so if you're constantly bombarded by the images of a particular kind of world, then you begin to see yourself differently. You begin to see yourself through through the lens of that world. Your identity is shaped by it. And so when I thought of landscapes, when I thought of experiences, when I thought about love or relationships, there was a particular kind of model that I thought of. It was the model that I had experienced in that kind of literature, the kinds of landscapes that I thought about that populated my mind, even though I'd lived in the desert, right? When I thought about landscapes, I thought about particular forests.
You mean ideal landscapes?
Yes, ideal landscapes. Or even not just
or
ideal.
Just the word landscape.
Just the
forest.
The world, yes. And so when
Well, that's the insidious part. If I may stop you there, the insidious part is A, that you take it on, but B, that you stop thinking critically about the fact that you've taken it on and that it doesn't really jibe with your personal experience when you stop thinking critically about
it. Yes, absolutely. But then the moment that I read Arab Woman Writers, that was the moment of the critical intervention in that consciousness.
One piece in particular moved you. Tell us about it.
I read The Story of Zahra by Lebanese writer Hanan el-Sheikh. It's a wonderful book about a Lebanese woman who finds herself embroiled in the Lebanese civil war. And she ends up having a relationship with a sniper whose name she doesn't know, and he eventually kills her. I mean, it's a tragic story, but it really is about women and nation and their involvement in conflict. But what was especially moving for me was not just the tragedy. I mean, it's a tragic story, but the fact that this was for the first time ever, I was reading a text, a novel, beautifully written. So it wasn't just about content, but the aesthetics of it were brilliant, that had the characters, the names were in Arabic. I mean, Zahra. It was a name that I understood. I knew. She was talking about places that I knew, that I'd visited, food that I knew, that I ate. So all of a sudden, the axis of my world shifted, and it was like I was reading something that was about me, even though we're talking about a Lebanese woman who was sleeping with a sniper. I mean, really, clearly not about me. But it was so much closer to my experience that I felt incredibly validated as a human being. And I think that's what's so both sad and joyful at the same time, that literature has that power to validate our being. And so for the first time, I felt represented.
So it's one thing to say that a woman who is writing can reach you in this way. Do you think the author in this case was consciously feminist?
Yes, I do. In fact, Hanan el-Sheikh had a really hard time publishing this text. When she wrote it, she thought it was going to sell immediately. It was such a brilliant book. But she wasn't able to publish it for many years, and she eventually had to publish it on her own dime. And then it was banned in the Arab world. It was sexually explicit. It was banned in the Arab world. And so the text is very consciously feminist. It's about an Arab woman's dealings with the patriarchal practices, patriarchal religious institutions, but also the ways in which a woman's body is used and abused by political powers.
And you've said and thought deeply about this, that you think Arab women writers, Muslim women writers in particular, use fiction as a way, as a form of expression rather than essay.
And that happens too. I mean, a lot of Arab and Muslim women write essays. Now in the 21st century, there are blogs. And Arab and Muslim women are using all the tools at their disposal. But I find literature to be a particularly fascinating way in which Arab women writers can really negotiate these minefields. To say something, so let me just back up and say that for an Arab and Muslim woman, to speak about oppression is much more difficult than it is for women for whom other aspects of their identity are not under attack. So an Arab and Muslim woman whose religious identity is under attack in the world where Muslims are under attack, for an Arab woman who's Palestinian or Syrian or Lebanese, when her national identity is under attack as an Arab woman because the world thinks of Arabs as terrorists. To speak about or to critique your Arabness, your Muslimness, is to be considered a traitor, right? You're airing the dirty laundry. And so you will be attacked by your own, right? Because you are undermining identities that are already threatened and undermined. Right.
So in fiction, you say, particularly a story comes to mind that you use as an example, a woman who falls in love with a snake.
Yes, right. And so in this particular story by the Egyptian woman writer Alifa Rifat called My World of the Unknown, she falls in love with a snake who turns into a woman. And so it really is a very homoerotic encounter. And analyzed from that perspective, we can, you know, talk about it in those terms. But I also think that she uses that to talk about Islam, the ways in which we can reinterpret the Islamic message as very woman-centric rather than patriarchal. And so, yeah, they're using all these interesting creative strategies to talk about things that they couldn't talk about explicitly.
Is this coded language? Is this language coded that women are more likely to understand than men? So when a man reads it, he's reading a fable, he goes on,
yeah.
Particularly if he's in a position to censor or question your loyalty to the cause, to
yes.
your kind.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. In other words, it is something that unless one delves deep into it, can be simply referred to, it's a folk tale, it's a fable, it's merely literature, it's fiction, and yet once decoded can provide really powerful messages.
Your most recent article analyzes a story called My World of the Unknown.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yes, it's this particular story that I was just talking about, the woman with the snake. So what I was especially interested in there was that a lot of folks have analyzed, and this is a popular story, the way in which it's been analyzed by the literary circle, the critics, is from a psychoanalytic perspective, right? The snake, it's very Freudian, phallic. But Alifa Rifat, the writer, is a devout Muslim, an Egyptian woman who'd never even been to the West. And so it just seemed inappropriate to approach the text from that Western lens, that there seemed to be a better way to approach it in its context. And so I thought about the context of Islam and the way in which Alifa Rifat would have interpreted the Quran as an Islamic feminist, or at least the way I see her, and the way in which this snake and the way in which the snake images are approached in the Islamic texts, whether it's the Quran or the Hadith, and tried to use that lens, a local lens, an indigenous lens, a Muslim lens, to read the text.
What should I know about that context that would change the meaning for me?
Okay. Well, first of all, the Judeo-Christian tradition of blaming Eve for the fall and her temptation by the serpent is a story that does not exist in the Quran. Adam and Eve do exist in the Quran, but they are both to blame, and there is no serpent. And so one of the things that we can think about is the ways in which the image of the serpent has been co-opted, has been misinterpreted, is in fact an interloper. It's not part of Islamic tradition. And so first and foremost, the snake represents a misread or a misunderstood woman.
You talked about Islamic feminism a couple of times now. How would you define it?
Islamic feminisms, and I want to be clear that there are multiple feminisms, but Islamic feminism, generally speaking, is a feminism that finds its strength in the Islamic texts. It exists, operates within the parameters and the paradigm of Islam. And so that's its springboard, right? It does not attempt to ignore. It does not attempt to undermine. It does not attempt to reject Islam. It's a feminism that draws its worldview from the Islamic context.
This has been a critique, and I wonder how you respond to it. You will hear Western feminists in particular say, yeah, but look at the way they, Muslim Arab men, treat their women. You know, you need to do something about this. I mean, I wonder if you've sort of felt that critique, that Western critique from progressive circles in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Who say that women in the Muslim world aren't doing enough, or that we in the West should do something about it, because that as you suggested earlier, was part of the ideology of the war on terror. We had to build this whole vision of people who hated democracy, treated their women badly to bring progressives on board, and sold this whole bill of goods as though this exceptional nation, shining light on the hill, could bring all of these great freedoms to this poor, underserved world.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that there is a rich tradition of Arab and Islamic feminist activism. So Arab and Muslim women are doing it for themselves. They are engaging in their own struggles. They are fighting their own struggles. Besides that, this argument that Arab women don't know is really just, again, part of that rhetoric, this false consciousness that you don't know what's good for you, and so we know what's good for you. And again, that's part of a larger political discourse about how others need to be liberated. And it really is the bigger picture, of course, is all about resources. I think, and the ways in which, you know, if we undermine these particular groups, then we can legitimize use and abuse of their resources. But you said a lot of things there. What I would like to say is that there's this argument that regardless of what we say about Islam, that it's still a patriarchal religion. And I think the same can be said for all religions, especially organized religions, that they are incredibly patriarchal, that women are oppressed across the world, the globe, and that Islam is no more or less patriarchal than other religious practices. But what Arab and Muslim women are doing is fighting within their own contexts so that because they don't want to, a wholesale rejection of their nations. They love their religion. They love their countries. But they can use the tools at their disposal to be able to thrive and succeed.
Can you give us an example of a scriptural passage that would, in a sense, support this feminist point of view?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I can give a couple that take on different interpretive tasks. So one of the more famous Arab, not Arab, she's actually an African-American convert, Islamic feminist, Amina Wadud, reinterprets the Quran from a woman-centric perspective. And one of the particular verses addresses the ways in which a husband should treat his wife if she is not forthcoming, if she is not pliable, if she does not respond to him sexually. The verse seems to suggest that if a woman does not listen, then he is at liberty to beat her, right? And so that's one of those instances that seem to be a stark representation of that kind of misogyny. Amina Wadud looks at the words. The Quran was revealed to the Prophet at a particular time in history, and words that meant something then do not mean the same thing now. And so she looks at the word and its history and says that the word daraba, which means to beat, could at the time, or does at the time, mean to strike, not to beat. To strike means to actually not strike physically, but to strike, in other words, back off and don't engage. And so she seems to suggest that what that verse is saying is that if you are both in conflict with each other, then you should take some time apart to cool off. What a radical interpretation based on just one word. Another one is the verse on polygamy.
Can I come back to that?
Oh, of course.
We'll take a break, and we'll come right back to that as I continue my conversation with Guilford College Associate Professor Diwa Abdo. And we'll talk about that scriptural passage and more on the state of things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Diwa Abdo, who is an associate professor of English at Guilford College. And we were talking about Arab and Muslim feminism and ways of interpreting the text, the spiritual text. And you were just about to give me another example.
Yes, right. So the verse on polygamy, I mean, and of course, that's one of the most popular stereotypes about the Arab world, right, that a man can have multiple wives. Well, the verse on polygamy is pretty clear depending on whether you attend to the verse and the way that it's written. And the verse says in translation, obviously, that you may have one, two, three, four wives if you are fair and you will not be fair. And so the letter of the law is that you cannot be fair. you will not be fair with your time, with your love, with your energy. And so you can't have multiple wives.
It's a, if you are fair.
And you will not be fair.
And you will not be fair.
Yes. Wow. Another example is Islamic feminists who address the hadith, which are the sayings of the Prophet, not the Quran. So the Islamic texts and Islamic feminists deal with two bodies of work. The Quran, which was revealed to the Prophet, and of course the sayings of the Prophet and his biography. The hadith, some of them have been used to justify particular laws, particular policies, particular attitudes towards women, and some of them are very misogynistic. Now, a hadith is accurate if its lineage is accurate. And so what Islamic feminists have done is to investigate the history of these hadith and try and identify whether every person in that lineage is above board. And what some have found, like Islamic feminist Fatima Mernissi, that some of the most misogynist hadith have been passed down by men whose record is not above board, that they have been accused of perjury. And so they argue for striking out those particular hadith from the corpus.
It's fascinating. But all of this says you're working within the tradition.
Yes, absolutely.
And working, yeah. So you finished your PhD at Drew University, and then you went back to teach in Jordan. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
It was exciting. I was so delighted to go back to Jordan. I mean, after September 11th, it became emotionally difficult to stay in the U.S. My own personal life wasn't hard, but it was hard to be under the gaze constantly, again, as the other. And it was so tasking, just physically, to be constantly on one's toes. And so going back, it felt like a true return to home. And I wanted to teach Arab women. I mean, that was the thing, right, to put my degree to good use. And so I had a wonderful experience for the 5 years that I was there until it stopped being wonderful.
Well, talk about that. What happened?
I was trying to be active in my scholarship and, obviously interested in literature and publishing articles on Arab women writers. And then I published this piece that I was incredibly proud of because it was a comparative piece between an Irish play, Frank McGinnis's Carthaginians, and the story of Zahra that I mentioned earlier by Lebanese writer Hanan Sheikh, and the ways in which the two texts, the similarities and differences in how the marginalized other, in one case the woman, and then in the other the gay man, were used by national ideologies to bolster the national identity by undermining the other, and how the bodies of women and men are used in political conflict, the sexualization of war, if you will. And without even reading my article, I think they just read the abstract, the institution decided that my text was going against the ethos of the university, that it was anti-Islamic, and they asked me to resign.
Is it because? Do you think it's because you were analyzing a play that included a gay man, or
yes,
the threat to ideologies rooted in patriarchy?
I mean, well, I think it was all of that. I think those are all, they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
But the stated reason was that my focus on sexual fluidity was not in keeping with the university's mission, which was. It's a very conservative institution.
But who was going there? What kind of women were you said that you really wanted to work with Arab women.
Mm-hmm.
Were there a lot? And what strata were they coming from? Who were they? Who were your students?
I taught at two different institutions. So this is the second institution. Mm-hmm. The first institution, we're talking about middle class women. The second institution, because it was long distance learning, I had women coming from all over Jordan. I mean, the far reaches. Small villages who really, really wanted to pursue an education. But these were not the women who were necessarily going to be reading my article. I was teaching them a set syllabus, a set curriculum, so I wasn't going to be infusing any of this necessarily into what I was teaching. I think it was just that I was representing something that went so starkly against the institution's Islamic image.
What did that do for you? How did you feel? You talked about feeling that you were home, and then this. What happened? How did
it was traumatizing. It was incredibly traumatizing because I felt betrayed. I really did. I was going back to give my all to my nation and to my country and to my home, even though I'm Palestinian, having grown up in Jordan, even though, you know, Jordan is my second home, that's where I felt that I belonged, at least academically. and so I felt unappreciated and betrayed.
Did you what was the conversation? Was there any conversation at all, or was just a—
Yes, oh, absolutely. There was, because I challenged them. I wasn't going to take that lying down.
Right.
And so when I asked them to show me exactly where in the article it was anti-Islamic, they couldn't. And that's the power of ideology, right? I mean, it's
right.
So grand and so general,
right?
And then when you say specifically where, that's where it exploded or imploded, rather. I mean, it couldn't hold up.
Yeah.
And so they backed down and I stayed, finished the year, and then I came to the U.S.
Then you came to the U.S. right to Guilford, huh?
I did. I'd never been to North Carolina. I applied for this job. When I read the job description, it was catered to me. It was like just spoke Dia. And so I came for— – they flew me in from Jordan for the interview, and I loved it.
It's interesting. I mean, as a nominally Quaker institution,
mm-hmm.
we know institutions have their institutional side, but they also have a set of values and an
mm-hmm.
ethos.
Yeah.
This is rooted in Friends' theology and ideology, which has been a kind of a stand apart, a sort of an outlier in the orbit of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you sense that, if there's that kind of outsider from the insider ethos or aesthetic in a place like Guilford.
Yeah. To me, even though I was the outsider, what Guilford represented was very much the kind of home that I was looking for. So I didn't feel like an outsider. The ethos of the college is very much about community and bringing folks in from multiple walks of life, emphasizing diversity. And so I felt like an outsider among outsiders who had managed to create this small island.
You have two Arab-American daughters.
Yes.
How do you raise them? What do you do culturally?
I have a four-year-old. It's very challenging. I have a four-year-old and now a six-month-old child.
Well, that's plenty.
Both girls. Yes, I know. It's exhausting. And for me, I can say very safely that even though being a woman is very, very important for me, perhaps what is even more important to me is that I'm an Arab, first and foremost, that I'm an Arab Palestinian, but Arab, really. And so for me, the Arabic language is the pinnacle of that identity. And so what I would like is for my daughters to be fluent Arab speakers. I think of language, as I'm sure many people do, as a vehicle for culture. Without it, I feel that one cannot live out fully their national consciousness. And so I would like my daughters to be fluent Arab speakers so that they can live out fully that Arab identity.
How do they feel about that?
Well, the four-year-old is playing along so mm-hmm. far. So I'm very strict about the fact that she needs to speak to me in Arabic, and then I need to speak to her in Arabic. And she has begun to challenge me. I'm sure this challenge and resistance will grow. She is immersed in a monolingual culture, and it will be easier. It'll become easier for her to speak English. And in fact, I've noticed that it has already. She'll speak more to her father than to me because she's finding it difficult to articulate certain things in Arabic. And so I wonder if it's going to be a choice between a relationship with my daughter or her Arab identity. It's a choice I don't want to make, but I don't know.
Well, and that gets to some of the things about American culture. We talked about the American critique of mm-hmm. Islamic culture and, you know, its relationship to democracy, et cetera. And, of course, the critique from the Arab and Muslim world is that the Americans have commodified everything and find nothing sacred. And this could be, language, history, all of those mm-hmm. things. Is that part of the teaching, and is that going to be a difficult challenge in this environment, in this American
mm-hmm.
environment?
Yes. I mean, for a four-year-old, she doesn't understand why it's important.
Yeah.
I can talk to her all the time about why it's part of your identity. But the word identity, what does it mean to
right.
a four-year-old? I know when she's 16, she'll know that it's important, that if I don't do it, she will mourn it later on. But right now, I'm worried about the risk, and I'm worried about the price that I will have to pay on a personal level. How will I damage just the mother-daughter relationship to be able to achieve what I think is so politically important?
How about teaching? How different is that here in the United States at a place like Guilford from what you were doing in Jordan?
Right. Well, it's very different, but equally, for me, politically significant. So when I was in Jordan, it was very important for me to be teaching Arab women and to be learning from Arab women. And I engaged with them in terms of, especially on gender issues. And so for me, it was a kind of a raising of a consciousness. And then here, I'm much more focused on issues of race, culture, ethnicity. So it's raising consciousness about those issues. So it's sort of focusing on different things. But for me, like all teaching, it's about raising awareness.
Dia, great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dia Abdo is an associate professor of English at Guilford College. And you can find out more about her work and other activities that we do and programs that we talk about here on The State of Things at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Sean Wen, and Megan Mataferi. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.